Morning, Chair.
Morning. Yes, your morning, Sanat. Hello. What? Morning.
Morning, Chair.
And compliments.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Missy, you guys, hi.
Yes, miss you too, Chair.
Is it seeing the other computers? No. Ah, Baba Susavoniva.
Are we ready, Lindy? Can we start the meeting?
Good morning, Chair and members.
Morning, Suri. Compliments.
Yes, we are more than ready, Chair.
I can't hear you.
Yes, Chair, we are ready. You can start the meeting.
Okay. Can you? Okay, let me just. Okay. Thank you, Lindy, very much. I think let's start our meeting. Can we just bow our heads where we are and make a little bit of a short prayer? Thank you very much. Lindy?
Sir?
Yes, thank you very much. Maybe it will be good for us to flight the agenda. Whilst you are doing that, let me take the opportunity to welcome everyone in our first meeting in 2022. I hope everyone has rested enough. I know for a fact that we don't rest. We are working 24/7 throughout the year, but I am happy that we are all back at work. And I hope that we will be more energetic than even the previous years. Thank you, Lindy, and honorable members, it's with great pleasure to have all of you again, and we know that we finished last year I would say the work that we were doing of the public hearings, which was the others that time, and now we will see them. Thank you very much, Lindy, for writing the agenda. It's not going to be a very, very long agenda today. We will just be brief and to the point, otherwise free to discuss and debate. And if you see that this agenda that has been proposed, solely looking at these issues that are here, you can just submit to Lindy whatever that you think is missing that we have to discuss as the committee. With those words, I wish to thank you, everyone that is present in the meeting. The next item in the meeting is an introduction by us and also support staff. Lindy, we will start introducing ourselves, which I think, let me try and open up the video. I don't know whether it's going to come up, but my name is Nongo Simvana. I am being deployed to be the chairperson of the social development with my colleagues, which I think they will have to introduce themselves. Let me also give over to the other one who's present in the meeting. Honorable members, introduce yourself. Good morning. Good morning.
I am the one and only Honorable Letitia Ari. I want to say to each and everyone, good morning. And if the first time I see you in this year, Happy New Year. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Aris. Thank you very much, my colleague. The next one who's
good present. Morning. Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, Manane. Hi, hi, Honorable.
Good morning. My name is Kensani Kate Bilangulu Mahabane. I'm the member of this portfolio committee. I'm happy to be amongst you guys, honorable members, today. Thank you very much.
Yes. Thank you very much for correcting yourself to say guys to us. Thank you, Honorable Kate. The next one.
Good morning, Honorable. Honorable Chair and colleagues, and also staff members, Happy New Year. My name is Jane Wakamangani. I'm one of this Committee of Social Development. Thank you.
Thank you, Mejane.
Good morning, honorable members.
There's Manane coming up.
Morning, honorable members, and greetings in the year of 2022. I am sitting in Mhlongo, and I'm looking forward in this committee. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Nane.
Good morning, Chair. My name is Bridget Masango, and I am the member of this portfolio committee, and I am so happy to be back with the work of the committee, and I wish everyone all of the best, and that God will bless us all.
Thank you very much, Honorable President Nkami.
Good morning, Chairperson, and good morning, colleagues and the staff and our guests. My name's Alexandra Adams, and I'm very excited to actually get started on the real work of this Children's Amendment Bill. Morning, everybody.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you very much, Alex.
Good morning, everyone. Good morning, everybody.
Are there any other ones, Lindy, that have not introduced from the side of the honorable members?
Yes, good morning. Oh. Good morning, honorable members.
Good morning.
Members of the staff, our guests, compliments on the season, for the work ahead, and for the new season, and I wish God can protect us and give us strength to render services to our people. My name is Dikgang Stok. I'm also a member of the portfolio committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, our whip. Is there anyone? The last one? I think that's all. Can we then say that, Lindy?
Sure.
Lindy, from your side, I can see that there's a lot. How are we going to do it from the side of the official? Still there, Lindy? Lindy, where? Honorable members, am I audible?
Siyakuzwa, you are audible enough.
Oh. And where is Lindy? Where?
Sorry, Chair. Sorry, I think I had a technical glitch. I was speaking and I was speaking to nobody. I was muted. Thank you very much. Chair, from our side, I will just confirm the support team that is in this meeting just to save time. Yolisa is here, our content advisor. We have Siyavuya. Our researcher is also here. We have Tandi, and the executive secretary, and myself, Lindy Iwe, as the committee secretary of this committee. Chair, also, I wish to confirm that we have 9 members, which forms a quorum for this committee. The committee can take formal decisions because we are a quorum. Also, Chair, I don't know when, there's also Prof. was also here. Thank you, Chair. Professor.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you very much, Ms. Lindy Sabo. We wish to have Professor N. I think we have to make mention of her name. We are happy to be with her. That will be the next item.
Chair, I've received 2 apologies. Member Sukas will be in and out of this meeting. She's taking her daughter to the doctor. But she will observe the proceedings. Also, Member Fandameve has a doctor's appointment. She will join the meeting at 10 o'clock. Those are the 2 apologies. Safe to say, Chair, this meeting is only for members and Professor Skelton. Don't have the departmental officials who are formally been invited, but they are also here as observers. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Lindy. Let me also welcome the legal advisor by the name of Unathi, Mr. Jengane. We are happy that you have joined us. We hope that we will have a very successful meeting today, Unathi. Thank you very much for indicating that you are here with us. Can we then adopt the proposed agenda in front of us? Lindwe has already flighted it.
Chair, I move for the adoption of the agenda.
Thank you very much. Alex has adopted the agenda. Any second, Honorable
I'm second.
Thank you very much. Let's proceed with the same agenda that has been flighted. And the next item is briefing by Prof. Professor, can we quickly give over to you to tell us what you have brought for us? We are happy to be with you, as I have said. Over to you. The platform is yours, Prof.
Good morning, honorable members. And I also acknowledge the presence of the support staff and the department officials and members of civil society who are observing. My name is Anne Skelton. I'm a professor at the University of Pretoria but I'm also a member of the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child, and I'll be drawing on that experience and my knowledge of the Children's Act also in this presentation. I'm going to just share my screen so that we can see my PowerPoint presentation. I was asked to talk about the age of the majority and also to draw from international regional context. And I know that what has been topical and what people have been wondering about is the whole debate, age of majority, the harmonization of ages. If the the background, I think, to this is, of course, that over time, the age of majority has moved a little bit in law, because it has been set at different stages by different societies, and it's based on societal views about children, about maturity, about what defines adulthood. And this is different for different cultures, and it's different for different countries. And over time, within the cultures and countries, it has changed. So, for example, prior to the Children's Act, the legal age of majority in South Africa was 21. You probably all remember that stage, and we still make a big fuss of the 21st birthday, although there's not really any logic to that, particularly anymore. The move to 18 as the age of majority began worldwide, really following the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child and the African Charter on the Rights and Welfare of the Child, that both set the upper age limit of childhood at 18 years. Actually, of course, we should remember that our own constitution also sets the upper age limit in the sense that it says that everyone below the age of 18 is a child and would enjoy children's rights under the constitution. And therefore, it's important to recognize that even if children are allowed to do certain things at an earlier age than the age of majority, that does not make them adults. They remain children, and they remain So for all of these reasons, the Children's Act came in line with that age of 18. We have to remember, of course, that childhood spans 18 years, and that's a long time. It's clear that as children grow up, they change. So we cannot have a one-size-fits-all policy that approaches children who are 1 year old the same as children who are 17 years old or 10 years old. You know, they're all at different stages of development and maturity. And therefore, child law would have this idea of children gradually maturing during childhood is captured by the concept of evolving capacity. In other words, as a child grows, they start off with very limited capacity. They can't decide things, they can't choose things when they are small. But as they grow older, they become more and more able to do that. And we refer to that growing developmental phase as evolving. It is true that children of all ages need something as they grow older. As they get closer and closer to adulthood, we give them more and more decision-making powers. And I think also a kind of modern approach to child law means that when we're making really important decisions about children, we have to consider their views. So the consideration of children's views and opinions starts from quite early on. How much weight one would attach to the views of a seven-year-old, how much you would attach to the views of a 15-year-old. And again, you know, this is how evolving capacity helps us to all, remember, we should always listen to the views of the child when we're making decisions about them. We should know what they want. But what they want will not necessarily be what the decision of a court, for example, or a school might be. But as they grow older, their views will have more and more weight, particularly in personal areas of their lives, such as which parent to live with. You know, so as children get closer and closer to 18, the courts are very likely to go along with what a child of 16 has indicates as their preference. So this flexibility of evolving capacity is great in the sense because it helps us work with children who are developing, but it does make it a little bit difficult because obviously in order to provide certainty, lawmakers like yourself need to set age thresholds for different things because we need certainty in the law. People such as, you know, be it police officers, parents, teachers, social workers all need to know, so at what age can a child do this, or at what age can a child decide that? And so we can't put all of that at the age of majority, so we have these different age thresholds. And interestingly enough, this has actually very long been part of the law. Going back to Roman law, there was three phases of childhood. The first one was called infans in Latin, below seven, impubes, between 7 and 14, and pubes, 14 to 18. We can recognize from those Latin words the word puberty, for example, and the word infant, which we still use in English today. In African customary law, childhood often ended through different markers, such as circumcision or certain rituals being carried out. But even in African customary law, the idea of different ages indicating maturity transitions, although a ritual might indicate some kind of passage from one stage to another, it might be that the person would still be considered a child until they left the household, for example. So on the harmonization question that often is raised, the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child does not require a harmonization of ages. It gives states, parties, countries some leeway on where to set these lower and internal age limits. So only if they are very low or if they cause, you know, harm, does the committee perhaps ask a particular state to raise an age limit that is below the age of 18. I will come to the age of marriage in my next slide, but the committee doesn't criticize states that have different ages for different things unless those ages are very, very low. And if they are, then the committee will generally say, you know, please raise that age limit, and sometimes even say preferably up to a certain age, like 14 or whatever it is. So examples of these that we can point to is the age of sexual consent. In South Africa, of course, under the Sexual Offences Act, our sexual consent age is 16. That would be considered perfectly acceptable by the Committee on the Rights of the Child. Many countries have a age of sexual consent at the age of 16. But we also would probably not raise eyebrows if the age was 15 or 14. If the age was 12, we might say, you know, have you considered raising that age? Age of criminal responsibility. The committee prefers the age of criminal responsibility to be 14, and this is because of the harmful effects of being taken through the criminal justice system. But again, you know, many states have 12 as a minimum age of criminal responsibility, including South Africa, since our parliament recently changed the law from 10 up to 12. Age of medical decision making is also another one where the committee will allow states a wide range of a large margin, because it is considered a very personal area of a growing adolescent child's right to be able to make decisions. So, you know, generally speaking, we accept that most countries will have staggered ages for this or a lower age than majority. Although often, usually, surgery goes with the age of majority. But other types of medical decision-making could be younger or lower. And you'll remember that last year there was a little bit of a flurry in the media around the issue of vaccinations and whether or not children would be able to get vaccinations even though they were below the age of 18. And the answer is, in our law, under the Children's Act, they would be able to. Age at which a child should consent to his or her own adoption is one of the lowest ages that we have in our law. The Children's Act allows children who are 10 or even younger, if they have sufficient maturity, to indicate whether they want to be adopted. So let's say a child is 10 or 11 or even 9, but quite a mature child, then we would also want, the court has to know what the views of the child are before making a decision to finalise the adoption. Again, this is because it is such an important decision, and children of that age can decide, well, do I want to live with these people? Do I want to be adopted by these people? Or, for example, you know, it could be a situation where the mum has remarried and she wants the stepfather to adopt the child. It's very important to know whether the child also wants that to happen. So as we can see then, it's very fluid and flexible, and that does make it untidy, I acknowledge. However, to capture evolving capacities, it seems there really isn't another way. I should say something particularly about the age of marriage, because there has been a global mobilization against child marriages and a call to set the age of marriage at 18 years for both boys and girls. And in the African Charter on the Rights and Welfare of the Child, this is absolutely clear. It says the age of marriage should be 18 for both boys and girls. The UN convention is actually not so clear, and that's one of the differences between the convention and the charter. But despite that uncertainty, the CRC committee does generally call on states parties to set the age of marriage at 18. So the committee has gone, despite the kind of lack of clarity in the convention itself, the committee has moved to that position of, look, you know, marriage is a lifelong thing. There are so many possible harms and abuses that can occur. Let's make sure that states set the age of marriage at 18. But interestingly enough, the committee does not call on states to raise their age of sexual consent to the same level. And sometimes people find this confusing. Well, you know, what are you saying? People can have sex, but they don't have to get married. And of course, from some religious perspective, that's questionable, so on. So why do we have these differences? Well, the problem is, if you set your age of consent at 18, then a lot of children, because that would then be an offence to engage in sex below a certain age, the committee doesn't want to see children who engage in consensual sexual behaviour being treated as criminal. And by the way, we actually have much the same approach to marriage. We don't really take a highly criminalization approach to the age of marriage either. We simply ask states to bring their law in line, but we certainly would never want to see children prosecuted, and even prosecuting parents who have consented to their child's marriage doesn't seem broadly a wise way to go, because the child is going to go back to live with the parents if that marriage is nullified due to the problem with the child's age. So the idea is to make a law and then try to find ways to help children who got trapped into child marriages to get out of those marriages, to provide the support and help that they need. So the upper age limit of childhood at 18 is not, in my view, controversial. It is a world standard that almost all countries follow, and South Africa's following of that is not really out of step at all. It's absolutely in line with international and regional practice. the setting of internal lower age limits is appropriate, in fact, in recognition of the evolving capacity of the child. So to answer the question, is it advisable to harmonize ages? You know, should we tidy it up? Why 12 here, why 14 there, why 16 there, and so on? Well, generally, from a legal perspective, it isn't considered necessary. But if harmonization of ages is considered, then it must be done according to an evidence-based approach, and the harmonization should not result in rights being reduced, because we shouldn't go backwards on our rights commitments, particularly in a constitutional democracy like South Africa, where we prize our respect for children's rights, and therefore harmonizing that goes back on advances we've made would possibly be considered to be a retrogression. And in human rights law, it's not a good idea to regress, to go backwards. Those would be the indications that I could give about if any harmonization of ages is considered. These would be the two really important principles. It must be evidence-based. There must be a good reason for doing it. And secondly, no rights reductions should result. But as I've said, it doesn't really, legally, it's not necessary. Thank you for listening, and I'm here to answer any questions or receive any comments.
Bro?
Yes, that's my presentation. I'm just here to answer any questions that you might have or comments.
Okay. Yeah, thank you very much, Prof. Honorable members, can I check, are there questions out of the presentation by Prof? I can see Honorable Aris and Honorable Alex Abrams and the other hands will come up. Over to you, Honorable Aris.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you very much, Prof, for the presentation. Can you hear me? Chair, can you hear me?
Yes, we hear you.
Thank
you.
Thank you very much, Prof, for the presentation. I just have a question that I would like to ask. As we have in these days, we find that teenage pregnancies, where children become mothers as young as 12 years old. And if you look at the children of these days, they are maturing much faster than the age of 18. Now, my question is that in terms of their rights, where do you see them? Do you still see them, or do you still classify them as part of the minor, because they have the responsibility of a parent now? So I just need clarity on that. And then in terms of you have said that consensual sex being at the age of 16. So which means that at the age of 16, when you have consensual sex, you already can become a parent. You know, you can conceive. So where do you draw really the line between the age of maturity in terms of 18? Is that in this time that we live, still age that we truly can say that is the age of maturity? Because as I said, children as young as 12 years, you know, already conceived in this day.
Thank you, Honorable Harris. Honorable Alex.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, Professor Skelton, for the presentation. My question, I would like to hear Prof's point of view on, you know, intersex children. And we had a presentation from the organization involved in intersex regarding, you know, consent and parental consent when it comes to these medical operations to change a child's sex. And we also heard from the organization that it has long-lasting and sometimes irreversible, you know, emotional, mental scars when these children grow up to adulthood. And unfortunately, it's sometimes still it's still being practiced in hospitals where doctors undertake, you know, this intersex operation, you know, just on, you know, parental consent. So yes, 12 is the age for when, you know, children can consent to medical procedures. And, you know, if they don't have parents, you know, that responsibility then falls on the provincial HOD to make these medical, to provide medical consent, yes. So I'd just like to hear Professor's viewpoint on intersex surgeries and the role between parents and doctors and the child involved in those operations. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Abrams. And I also see the hands of Honorable Masango, Honorable Shongo, and Honorable Stock. Over to you, Honorable Bridget.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you so much, Prof, for the presentation. It was short and sweet and to the point. I just wanted to ask, some of the comments that were coming out of the public hearings were comments that were, if one could attribute them to anything, it would be from a protection sort of position by the caregivers, you know, parents and all those people that were raising they're making the comments in terms of they felt, at least from what I could gather, they felt that they do not have any role to play in protecting their children because the law has gone ahead and set out all these age limits. And so they felt helpless, like they felt that they have no role to play in terms of making sure that their children are still protected from things like, you know, having sexual interactions with older people and things like that, because they can make up their mind about what to do in things that parents still feel that they should have a role to play in protecting the children. So my question is, in the deciding of the various ages of maturity, even though they are flexible in order for them to be still based on the best interest of the child, was protection or was the role of parents ever considered? And to follow that on with a question that says, the prof was saying that if we want to harmonize, if harmonization is discussed, it must be based on research, it must be based on evidence-based research and things like that. I just wondered what form would that evidence-based research take in, if it's possible to actually just say it would have to cover 1, 2, 3, and 4. But otherwise, it makes so much sense to hear about the evolving capacity and all those things, which then means that it doesn't restrict, you know, the children and the caregivers and the law even in terms of deciding on a case by case basis when these things have to go to before the law and things like that. But thank you so much, Prof, for the presentation. Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much, Honorable Masango. Then can we give over to Honorable Stembile?
Thank you very much, Chair. And thanks for the presentation, Prof. I think Honorable Masango has covered me. I also wanted to know that when taking these decisions, were parents consulted or considered? Because taking from the public hearings, most of the complaints would come from society and community about these child marriages. So, like I said, Honorable Masango's question really covered me.
Okay. Thank you, Honorable Msongo. Can we give over to Honorable Stock? Over to you, Honorable.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable members in the meeting. Thank you very much. Let me also join my colleagues in appreciating the presentation by Prof. Skelton. It's quite comprehensive and quite detailed as well. And it also clarifies a number of misunderstanding or the confusion that some of us had in relation to the definition of a child, whether it's at 16 or whether it's at 18, as prescribed by the South African Constitution. So I want to put something to you, Prof, in terms of the constitutionality of any legislation that prescribes the age of children to the age below 18 years, because we know that the Constitution, we're all clear, and you also indicated in your presentation that in terms of the Constitution, the age of children is actually prescribed in terms of the Constitution, the age of 18. So I want to find out from you, Prof, where does it put us now as a committee? If we come across any legislation or any other best practice that has been actually put forward or actually raised in terms of the research that has been conducted, where does it put us as a committee? And I also want to appreciate the fact that you actually went to the extent of also indicating in your presentation about the international, the national, and also the regional practices in your presentation. I actually want to appreciate that. But the only thing, Prof, like I indicated to you, which I want you to actually be more elaborate and put more emphasis on for the purpose of the meeting, is to stay in terms of the constitutionality of any other legislation that comes or which was actually put forward. Which one is superior more than the other? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Weep. Thank you. I can see that Honorable Sukers have joined us. I'm not sure, Honorable Alexandra, is it the old hand or
new hand, Chair, for quite a question?
Okay. Let's give over to you and then give over to Marie. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Just a question that I thought about right now. I know Prof said that, there's no need to harmonize the ages, but at the beginning of every year, we debate, education and the fact that our schooling system is in a crisis. We look at high dropout numbers, and we know that children drop out for a myriad of reasons. But now we are saying that for schooling, you can't force a child over the age of 15 to go to school. However, the average child is only in grade 7 when they are 15 years old. And, during the public hearings, we heard parents say, but we can't force our children to go to school because they know their rights and they know they can't be forced to go to school over the age of 15. And with this education crisis that we are currently facing in South Africa, wouldn't that harmonization of ages, help our education system and also empower our parents with their children? But also, at 15, and if you are dropping out because of peer pressure, it only sets you back as a child by not finishing school or not choosing to go to a trade school in that sense. So, you know, understand that there's no need to harmonize, but surely the argument for improved education to harmonize there is there not one. Thanks, Jay.
Over to you and welcome, Honorable Speaker.
Thank you, Chair, and good morning to everyone, and especially to our committee members. I am very glad to, even if it is on the platform, to be again busy in social development. My question, Chair, I have missed the presentation. I, however, have gone through the presentation. I think it would be very helpful if Professor could comment on the following. We are dealing with various pieces of legislation. We are currently in the basic education space busy with the Bella Bill. It's just starting. Then we have the Children's Amendment Bill, which we've just concluded the public hearings, and of course that this presentation is speaking to. Now, the one thing about the harmonizing of age is very important for us as a committee, as stressed by my colleagues previously, because it certainly was one of consistently during the differences in the different legislation. Now, one of the hearings in the early part, Professor mentioned how the legislation is siloed almost. And one of the things that we need to, attempt to do in this committee is to be cognizant of the various legislations and its impact on this bill, which is the Children's Amendment Bill. So the issue of harmonization is very important to us as a committee when we are considering the legislation coming up. And so I would appreciate it, again, if you could reiterate for us, I see that it's not important in the presentation, and of course I didn't hear the nuance in you presenting it verbally. It's an issue that we, however, strongly consider, or I do, because we're dealing with various legislation and the need for us for that legislation to speak to each other. Then secondly, we are seeing now with the Epstein case that has happened overseas and the the settlement that has happened now with a high profile individual, the impact of certain conduct on children, especially early initiation into sexual activity. And when a child gives consent and years later as an adult, the impact of that on them. So the issue of informed consent as well in terms of this legislation is very important for us as a committee. And if you could please, in terms of also its impact on harmonization of age, because those are the things that we need to consider. How is children protected in legislation, and when can a child actually give informed consent? There was confusion. Or not confusion, but difference of opinion in terms of the interpretation of informed consent, when parents can give and all of that. It would be really helpful if you could elaborate from your point of expertise around informed consent and the consideration of the law in terms of that. Again, we also are faced as a country now with young people at the ages of 8, 10 and 11 having abortions in our constituencies. So informed consent for this committee is very important, and again, the harmonizing of age. So it's within this context that I would like for you to provide us with, from your experience and expertise to give us insight in terms of that and how we could apply ourselves in terms of the law. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Honorable Sukers. Prof, I think honorable members have covered all what we wanted to know, especially when...
Chair.
I beg your?
Chairperson.
Yes.
Mine was up.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry for that. Let me first give you honorable Kate. Thank you for reminding me.
No, thank you very much, Chairperson. One. And thank you very much, Prof, for the presentation. One issue, Chair, that I want to, I want the professor maybe to elaborate on it when, while giving the answers. It's about our constitution vis-a-vis our culture. Talking about harmonization of age, you'll find that most of the... Chair?
Yes, I'm listening. I'm sorry for that.
Okay. I wanted to say that our constitution is silent about our diverse cultures, because when you look at the child marriages, some of them, it happened because of our cultures. Mostly it's parents who will consent for kids to be married by this adult. But our constitution is quiet about it. So what is it that Professor maybe can advise this portfolio committee that maybe we'll see it proper for us as a committee to amend in order to find this harmonization of age, child marriages? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Kate. I think that's what I was going to sum up the questioning, because really we encountered so many questions during the public hearing in terms of these different ages. The other department is talking about 16 years and ourselves are talking about 18 years. Really, what is it that you can advise us of out of all what you have presented? Can I give over to you?
Yes, well, thank you very much. Really very interesting questions, and I'm going to try and answer all of them in turn. So the question from Honourable Aris, relating to the whole point that, you know, children seem to be getting pregnant young, having children young, and what impact does that have? Do they then become adults by view of the fact that they've had children? Interestingly enough, our law used to be, and maybe in a way still is, that when you get married, you become a major, at no matter what age you're at. However, since we have a constitution with a Bill of Rights, the position is now that even if you get married, I would say you still enjoy your protection as a child under the age of 18. Are you able to make certain decisions, for example, in relation to your child? If you have a child, you aren't married and you have a child below the age of 18. Yes, you can make some decisions, but our Act, the Children's Act, does not give guardianship to the mother until she's 18. Her parents are the guardians of her child until she's 18. And so we still recognize that she doesn't have full capacity to make all the decisions in relation to her child, and she'll need the assistance of her parents and guardians to do that. And then when she turns 18, then she becomes fully an adult and a mother. However, I would say it would be important if there was a decision being made about her child, such as should her child be given up for adoption, it would be essential to take her views into consideration, even if she isn't the guardian of the child, because she's the mother of the child, right? What would happen if a mother of a child were to be arrested for shoplifting? She would still be a child under our Child Justice Act, and she would still be a child under our Constitution. So that is necessary because she needs to be protected from the harmful effects of the criminal justice system. But if I'm sure, I understand they're kind of more complex than saying, at this age, you're an adult, and then you can do everything, and below the this age, you know, you're a child and you don't have any choices and you can't make decisions, but you are fully protected. It isn't that simple. It's actually a little bit of a balancing. And in my view, that balance is important to be able to recognize that children, you know, do sometimes get pregnant in their teens, have a baby, and we would want them to be able to say, I want to keep my child. I don't want to give this child up. I don't want to have an abortion. I want to make a decision for myself about what to do. Okay, so that's why you can see the importance of recognizing that on the one hand, she should be able to make certain decisions in relation to her child, her choices. But on the other hand, if something befalls her, like she gets caught up in the criminal justice system, she needs to be seen as a child, even though she has a child as well. And the way our law works at the moment, all of that is recognized because the Constitution is clear that below the age of 18, you are still considered a child and therefore all the protections would be available to you. I'm going to come in more detail to, so does that make the younger ages unconstitutional, which was the question that Honourable Stock asked, but I'll come to it later. Then the first question that was asked by Honourable Abrahams was the intersex question. So I can tell you that at the Committee on the Rights of the Child, we often give advice to states to say that they should move away from surgery that is unnecessary for intersex children. So sometimes surgeries are necessary because some intersex children, for example, can't urinate, so they would need to have surgeries to be able to urinate properly. But the kind of surgery that is considered unnecessary is surgery that would change a child into a girl or a boy. And that should not be done at birth or in the early childhood because you don't know yet what that person feels they are. So gender is very much an internal issue, something that people have as their sense of their identity, and that we can only see as they grow older. And therefore, it makes a lot of sense not to, parents might find it convenient to say, I want to raise my child as a boy or a girl, and therefore let's just try and go with the surgeries that will help us align with that decision. Parents will still possibly have to make a decision whether to raise their child primarily as a girl or boy because society is so binary at the moment. But perhaps as time goes on, we'll get people to accept that, you know, sometimes you can't choose for the child, and the child over time will demonstrate and be clear, this child's definitely looking like she is playing with the toys that are for girls, and she's wanting to select in clothes that are for girls, so therefore, you know, she's a girl. But all surgeries that are unnecessary should be delayed until the child can be involved in that decision making. What has been happening internationally, although I'm not so aware that it's a big issue yet in South Africa, but maybe in some families it is a big issue, is that there are now intersex children in their teens who are kind of demanding to be able to make decisions about surgeries as well as hormonal treatments. And sometimes they are, you know, demanding to be able to transition to the sex they feel more familiar with. This is a difficult one because on the one hand, it does still seem to make sense to stick with our rule that surgery must be delayed until 18. That's what our law says, and there's good reasons for that. But of course, hormonal treatments can also have quite irreversible effects. That's not surgery, that's medical treatment. So there I would say that the law should probably leave some space open to allow parents and doctors, and to be, you know, have strong ethical standards that allow for decisions around medical treatment to be made in a way that really is in the best interest of the child and takes the child's views into consideration, but keeps in mind that, you know, adolescence is a time of great change, and that sometimes a decision that is taken at 14, you know, that person might feel differently later. But the facts and circumstances of each case almost need to be determined there. So that is a complex area, and it's actually very new in the law to have to think about this. So what I hope that I've left you with the impression that there's a very clear answer to babies and early childhood, and it's more complex when we're talking about adolescence, inevitably, because of this tension that we find between protection and autonomy, growing autonomy. But let me tell you that as a child rights lawyer, I know we cannot escape that tension. We cannot escape that slight feeling of contradiction. If we do so, we tend to harm children. We should try to keep it fluid. And I know as lawmakers, your instincts may want to go against that. But I would urge you not to do so. The next question I will respond to is the one by Honourable Masango, which was to do with parents feeling that they are frustrated because they don't know what the role they should be playing. Well, it's an interesting point, and I understand it. And anyone who's parented adolescents knows how hard this is. Even if you have a whole lot of legal backup behind you, it's still difficult to parent adolescents because they are expressing their growing autonomy, and you as a parent are beginning to lose your control. I think we all know that. Any parent knows what that feels like. And anyone who's been an adolescent as well knows how much you push the boundaries, right? If you don't get the answer you want from one parent, you go to the other one. So that's just a reality. And perhaps the really good answer to that is, let's help people to strengthen their parenting of adolescents, because that would be a good solution. Our courts have already kind of expressed opinions on this to an extent, because some of you will know the Teddy Bear Clinic case, where the Teddy Bear Clinic challenged the constitutionality of the age of, there was a phase in our law where children below the age of 16, if they engaged in consensual sex between 12 and 16, would be charged or could be charged under the law. Our constitutional court struck that down because it exposed children to too much harm for decisions that are not essentially criminal decisions, right? And in doing so, the arguments on the other side were, well, you know, from the state, for example, and from the amicus curiae on the other side was, but we need the legal process. We need these laws here to help us parent. The Constitutional Court said, no, you don't. No, you don't. You can still make all the choices as parents that you want to make, and you don't need the law to do that. What the law has to do is to think about what effects would there be if we start putting children in prison or taking them into the criminal justice system for behaviors that are essentially not criminal, because that's public law, you know. And what you choose, I mean, our law allows children to have sex before they get married, but you as a family, you can still choose to say, to bring your children up to say, in our household, that is not the rule. In our household, we don't have sex until we get married. That's your choice. The law allows you to raise your parents, your children, as you would like to. But if something goes wrong, and it does, and your child does have sex before marriage, the police won't be knocking at the door. You as parents, you know, can bring in whoever you think would be appropriate, the elders from the community or the religious leaders, you know, to help you explain to your child why you think that's wrong. But you don't really want the police coming about personal issues like that. So I hope that helps to answer that question. Were parents consulted in the drafting of the Children's Act? Well, there was a broad consultative process back. And I can't say that, you know, huge numbers of parents were consulted. But I do think that the Department of Social Development has an important role to play in helping parents to understand and be able to navigate the difficult path of parenting in the modern age. I think that's where we should, you know, think about putting our efforts, maybe put in something that ensures that parents that are struggling can get access to good services to support them in their parenting. The next question was about when making decisions, were these decisions, I think it was a similar question about how do we make, there was another question from Honourable Masango, which is important, and that as well, you know, if any harmonisation is going to happen, I've said, well, it should be evidence-based, and, you know, the question was, well, how would we actually go about doing that if we did do it? Well, the Constitution is a good guide in this regard, because in determining whether something is constitutional, the Constitution will always look at, well, what was the harm that you were trying to prevent through this law? And then if the law that you passed, did it in fact solve that problem? But was there something less restrictive you could have done to stop that change in the law? So let me say, on the issue of parenting, for example, if we say we need to have a law that criminalizes children for consensual sex because parents need more help with their parenting, the Constitutional Court said, no, they don't, because basically that doesn't go into the area of parenting. Parenting is a separate issue, and you can use less restrictive means. That's what the Constitutional Court looks at. Were there less restrictive means than changing the law? For example, if you decided to raise a minimum age to access condoms from the age 12, and you raised it up to 14 or 16 because it was the same as the age of consent, what the Constitutional Court would want to know if you were challenged on that would be, what was the basis on which you decided that? Did you, you know, what evidence did you look at? Was this legal change really necessary? And was there a less restrictive means of achieving the same purpose that you intended by that harmonization? So that's always important to keep in mind when you're making decisions, especially if they retrogress. In other words, if they seem to go backwards on previous rights gains. the next question, that brings me actually to this question about constitutionality, the question asked by Honourable Stock, which I think is a good question. It's an important one to examine. And that is, okay, so the Constitution says childhood is at the age of 18. So won't the Constitutional Court be upset if any of the other ages are lower? No, they won't be. What they would be worried about is if something is harmful to children and the age is set lower. They accept that there are different ages at which things can happen. Let me give an example. Because the court has dealt with age limits below 18 before, not the age of sexual consent. They didn't say the age of sexual consent should be changed. They were quite comfortable with it at 16, right? What they said was that children between 12 and 16 shouldn't age in sex, but that didn't change the age of consent. The age of consent is still 16. So if someone who's older has sex with a person under 16, that is still a crime. So it's only when they're both below 16 and over 12. Why 12? Because below 12, children are considered to be unable to make any decisions relating to sex. And our law is clear on that. So it doesn't matter if a person has any sexual interaction with a person below the age of 12, the child's consent does not come into it at all. It is always considered to be non-consensual. And if it's penetrative at all, it's rape. So our court and our legal system is used to different ages. So lawyers don't really have, and courts don't really have a problem with this. But one good example, as I think, is also the case that was brought about minimum sentences for child offenders who are 16 and 17. So our law said, a new law was passed, a sentencing amendment bill a few years back, which brought children, 16 and 17 year olds, into the realm of minimum sentences. And that meant they could be sentenced to very long sentences, including life imprisonment, in fact. And the constitutional, that was challenged by the Center for Child Law, and the Constitutional Court eventually ruled in that case that it was not permissible to bring children into the realms of minimum sentences. But interestingly enough, the court said ages below 18 can be set for certain things, but then it must be evidence-based, and there must be less restrictive means of achieving the same purpose. And the point is that children of 16 and 17 can be sentenced to lengthy sentences, up to 25, but not as a minimum sentence, as a last resort. And that's what our constitution says, also what the UN Convention says. So I hope that helps to throw some light, you know, on this. You know, it's complex. It's complex what we're talking about, but that the Constitutional Court is perfectly comfortable with lower ages at which one can do things. But if harm is very clear, criminalization in particular is something that they will be very concerned about, then they will generally feel that children have to be protected against those harmful effects of courts, criminalization, prisons, etc. One question that I missed, which I thought was a very interesting point, was the age of education ending at 15. I have to agree with you that that one does stick out as a sore thumb. The reason for it is the International Labour Organization's rules. They set the age of work at 15, and therefore the age of compulsory education was set to match that. It is quite old, though, that requirement that children must be in compulsory education up until the end of the year in which they turn 15, is what our law says. So that is in line with the ILO convention. Would it be appropriate to raise that to 16, say? Actually, 16 is a far more common age in our age. 15's really weird. We don't see 15 anywhere else. We've got 12, we've got 14, we've got 16, and we've got 18. And then the only one that is 15 is that education one. So I think you pick a good one. If you talk about harmonizing, that one might not be too a bad one. But remember again, what is the evidence base for it? And is there a less restrictive means to that goal that you would have in harmonizing? Generally speaking, tidying up the statute book isn't a great reason for doing it. And then another question that I was asked was harmonizing across the different laws. You know, shouldn't we be harmonizing across the different laws? Well, yes, to the extent that you don't want any contradiction. If you don't want a contradiction in one law that then makes it difficult to understand how the other law could work. One example of that was that the one law said that you could access condoms, but the other law said that you would be committing a crime if you engaged in consensual sex between 12 and 16. That problem was solved by the Teddy Bear Clinic judgment and the laws that the subsequent legal changes, because now you can, or at least you won't be treated as a criminal if you engage sexually. And I think the reason for this again was that our laws, you know, were passed with the idea in mind that, okay, we want to discourage children from early sexual debut, but if they're going to do it, we want to avoid pregnancy and we want to avoid STDs and AIDS. And so, you know, it's better to provide the barriers that can protect children under those circumstances. And then the last one, I think, was the question that I was asked about the culture and is our constitution silent? Actually, our constitution says that customary law and culture can be followed, provided that it doesn't contradict the constitution. What I can tell you unequivocally about this is that the Convention on the Rights of the Child and the African Charter on the Rights and Welfare of the Child are very clear about the fact that the age of marriage should be the same, even if we're talking about marriage under customary law. And actually, our Customary Law Marriage Act also sets 18 as the age of marriage. But of course, I am aware that there are many other cultural practices that are different. And so what I can tell you is that if South Africa were to not raise the age of marriage to 18 under customary law, or let me put it this way, would not make it clear that their age of 18 covers all kinds of marriages, including customary law, the Committee on the Rights of the Child and the African Committee of Experts is likely to ask South Africa, why did you not raise the age of 18 for all kinds of, and make it clear that applied to all kinds of marriages. So that much I can say. I know it's complex to try to conform and to regional and international regional frameworks, but that is something that I see the committees are both very consistent in the feedback that they give to states about. I hope I haven't taken too long, but you asked a lot of questions, so I had a lot of answers to.
Thank you, Professor. Maybe let me also check whether is there any follow-up. I don't see anyone. I think you have been clear enough. You made us to be clear on what was being asked by the community. Then, if it is the case, honorable members, okay, I can see your hand, my honorable member.
Chair.
Let's give over to you the follow-up.
Chair. I can say that mine is not that answered, but I understand her because she said it's a complex question. Really, it wasn't. Because the issue I was raising is the issue of child marriages that mostly happen when parents want children to get married at an early age without their consent, the children's consent, but the parents who are consenting for them. And the constitution is quiet about that. I was saying what can be the advice from her, but I understand she said it's a complex. Thank you very much, Chair.
Sorry, Chair, if I can then answer that question. So when children always have to consent to marriage under our law because the Children's Act requires that, it should not be happening. I understand that it might be happening, but it should not be happening that children are being married off without their consent. Let me be clear that what I'm saying is that I think South Africa should make the age of marriage 18 and should be clear that it applies to all kinds of marriage.
Okay, thanks, Prof. I don't see any hand for now, but I think, Prof, because it is really a complex issue, we still have some few questions that we have to ask, but we can maybe discuss this first and maybe agree upon on what is it, because the reality of the matter, when the communities are asking us as Social Development Portfolio Committee members, we can't say we are not sure, but we had to tell them, because if you don't know anything, you have to explain and tell people that this one you still have to go and consult.
Because what was really a critical issue is this thing of the constitution and ourselves as departments, not only social development, but even other departments, as I have said to you. And this consent thing, when communities are asking, how do you think that a 12-year-old can be able to have a consent in terms of procedures, medical procedures that can be undertaken? But I think you have made some clarity on some of other things. Honorable members, can we excuse Professor and thank her very much for the effort? I know you wanted to present this last year. You've been asking from Lindy where the date, but we were too tight by that time. Thank you. We will appreciate you from you to update us on few of other things that are coming up. Thank you, Professor.
You are the honorable members.
Thanks. Bye. Honorable members, let's proceed with our agenda. The next item on the agenda, Lindy?
Yeah.
I think it's the yes. I think it's the content advisor that is to brief us about the public hearings that we have undertook. Am I right?
Yes, you are correct, Chair.
Okay, thanks. Over to you, content advisor. Brief us about the very critical issues that came up, with the hope that every member managed to get the report, a summarized one, and were able to read it. And then Yoli is going to assist us in that. Over to you, Yoli. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson, and Happy New Year to all the members, my colleagues from the department and from the committee. I'm happy to see that all of us, we are here, we are safe, we are protected during the holiday time. Okay, Chairperson, let me just start sharing, not to waste time. The presentation is a bit long. But Chairperson, I would like to maybe propose that when I come to the issue of the different age, the issue of age, that I skip that one because Professor has already made a presentation and the members engaged on it. I had forwarded the report to Professor Skelton as well. So her presentation must have maybe made reference or she might have seen what was raised in the communities regarding the issue of age. So I would just ask the members of the committee that when I come to that section, just to save time, that I skip that one because it's already been dealt with. Nothing different is there that it would really go against what the professor has already presented. Having said that, Chair, in my opening remarks, there were quite a number of issues that were raised. I've flighted them. The issue of documentation, the issue of definition didn't come up that much. The issue of children not being documented, it came out almost from all the provinces. The issue of parental responsibilities and rights, the children's rights to privacy, it almost touches to the discussion that we just had. So I'm just going to highlight that part, Chairperson, as well. But I think Professor somehow has addressed it with the questions that we asked. The 3.5, Chair, as I asked, maybe I shouldn't just skip that one because it's already been dealt with. A little bit of child marriages, I'm going to talk about it because there are other issues that were raised that go beyond the issue of age. Then we had a lot of issues that were raised on the ECD. And foster care, Chairperson, also came up, adoption services. Little bit on the referral and placement of children in alternative care. Then also a little bit about the National Child Protection Register was also raised. And there were some other comments were made on the implementation of the bill. There's 3.10, which is a new proposal this maybe members may be aware of, it was also raised during our national public hearings. It also was raised in our provincial ones. There were other service delivery issues, Chairperson, that not necessarily relate to the bill that were raised. Just as an introduction, Chair, just to mention that what this presentation is about, and it's basically to highlight the key themes that came from the provincial hearings on the bill. And I'd like to just mention to the committee, or to emphasize, that the committee should really look at the reasons that were given by the public on the issues that they raised, because I think those are important for the committee to consider when they're deliberating, and most critically then the recommendations that the public made. And also just to also highlight that some issues that were raised, they are in a way interrelated. For example, like we just discussed now, when it comes to the issue of the sufficient age or the age of majority, when it comes to child marriages and inconsistencies between the legislation, which now we just dealt with in our chair, and it was also raised with regard to the exit age from children from the alternative care, which in this case, the foster care. Also, Chair, what we just discussed as well, the children's rights to privacy was raised in relation to parental rights, which Honorable Masango also alluded to when she asked a question. Chair, just to go through the statistical analysis, which is also important when we do our analysis of the of anything that we do, especially this one. If you look at the people who attended across provinces, Chair, we have a record of 4,095 people who attended. Then we had 526 people who made submissions. We also had that closed session with the children from the representatives from the Nelson Mandela Children's Fund. There were about 38 of those children. We also had 7 written submissions that were submitted from learners who came from a school for children with special needs that was in Northwest, in the Lekwa Dimane local municipality. Those children, they came into the hearing. And just to mention, Chair, that they came under the impression that they were going to make a presentation or a submission, but because certain procedures, as we advised in terms of following that framework on child participations, were not done. So those children could not, for their protection, because the session was televised, it was broadcasted. So to protect those children in line with the framework for children, then they were advised to submit those their presentations, which now were captured in the report. So we have those 7 submissions that were also captured. Chairperson, just to break it down in terms of gender representation, out of the 526 participants or people who made presentations, we had 367 females and we had 159 males. The provinces that had the highest number of representation in terms of women, it was the Mpumalanga with 69, Eastern Cape 51, Gauteng 48. In terms of Chair, I just moved something here that just taking me to another slide. There we go. All right. In terms of the speaker's view on the bill, basically those who are supporting or not supporting or who didn't indicate, we have the majority of 74% of people who said they're in support of the bill in terms of numbers, that is 388. We had 9% of people who rejected the bill, which is like in terms of numbers 46. And then we had 17% of people who did not indicate. Let me just explain, Chair, that the majority of the participants or those who made oral submissions did not support the bill in its current form, whilst the organization that is the, it's called Fathers for Justice organization, they said they did not support the bill in its current form. However, they supported the public hearing process. We also had a number of speakers from the ECD sector in the Free State who also rejected the bill based on the submissions that they made. I just thought I should highlight that, Chairperson. Okay, moving on from the statistical analysis now to go into the crux of the matter, the main submissions that were made in terms of the content. In terms of the definitions, as also part of the bill, what was the people's view on it? Well, there was a submission, people who are from the disability sector, they supported the inclusion of children with disability in the amendment in clause 45A1. And then with regard to section 21 of the bill, the participants or the speakers, they raised a concern about the use of a reasonable period that is not defined. That is from mainly that section deals with a father who has to acquire the parental rights and responsibilities if that father has been contributing or has attempted to contribute to the upbringing of the child for a reasonable period. So the fathers, they felt that that is not clearly defined, what is this reasonable period? And one even raised a question, would it be the 5 days after 30 days where they are allowed to have access to the child? Would that be considered as reasonable? That was a question that was asked. And then in clause 12, that is amending section 22 by inserting paragraph 2A and in terms of section 129 of the Act, there is a use of sufficient maturity. So even then, Chairperson, the inputs or the concerns was that the sufficient maturity is not defined. So basically, these are the two phrases or concepts that are used that the public felt that they were not clearly defined. Okay, Chair, just to go now to the 3.2, which speaks to the registration of children. There was a lot of input on this one, and all of them were premised on this clause, that is clause 5 of the bill that seeks to amend section 8, which clarifies that this act applies to every child in the Republic of South Africa. So even with those, that closed session, that session what we had with those children, they particularly highlighted the fact that the bill aims to specify or clarify who this act is applicable to. So having said that, Chair, now these are the concerns that we raise, that there are children in South Africa, both from born in South Africa and those who are non-South African who are not documented. And because of that, these children are not able to enjoy the benefits, government benefits, such as the social grants. They can't get paid social grants. And because these children cannot be admitted at ECD centers, even though some ECD managers, they say they do admit these children for the keeping the principle of the best interest of the child. So they admit these children. These children are enrolled in school as well, but when it comes to them sitting for matric examinations, they cannot because they don't have proper documents. And the reason given for that, some of reasons given by the public was that the regulations or policy of the Department of Home Affairs, it does not allow unmarried fathers to register their children. So if a child now stays with the father, that child now, listener, is not registered, so that child won't have the proper documentation that the child needs because the law doesn't allow fathers to register their children on their own, or they must undergo paternity tests, which I'm going to talk to it later, as well as families who are looking after children whose parents are not known, or their whereabouts are not known, or maybe the parents are deceased or one parent is deceased, those children cannot be registered as well because of that. And also that the fact that Home Affairs is not accessible, the offices are in town, people have to travel and spend money, and they travel more than once in some instances because they're saying the offices are quite inefficient, the systems are always down, and there's always long queues. So that now impacts on the registration of children. So what were the recommendations made? That government should make sure that all undocumented children are documented because they were born in South Africa. The Department of Social Development and the Department of Home Affairs should work together to review and reconsider this matter in the best interest of the child. The bill should also provide a legal remedy to the challenge of registration of children born either from a non-South African mother or father. So meaning one parent is South African, the other one is not. This should be aligned with Section 21 and 22 of the Children's Act, number 38 of 2005. Now, Chairperson, just going to the next part, which is now parental responsibilities and rights. I'm just going through all the slides quickly because there's quite a number of them. On this aspect, Chair, the inputs were, if I were to categorize them, but those people were more arguing for a traditional perspective on the matter, and then we have those who are basically fighting for the full parental rights of the father. However, in both instances, the participants were in support of the bill. However, I just want to note, as I said earlier, the Fathers for Justice, they made a submission that they reject the bill in its current form. It's just a repetition. Now, Chair, for emphasis. So, Chair, now going to the traditional perspective on the bill, mainly it was like for the traditional house, traditional leaders, if I can put it that way, who had those inputs that the bill should consider the cultural and customary practices that unmarried fathers need to fulfill, such as the payment of damages. For impregnating a woman as family. Therefore, the unmarried fathers have limited parental rights to a child born out of wedlock. In essence, that was their input, Chair, that there should be a balance and a recognition of the cultural practices that an unmarried father needs to fulfill before he can have full parental responsibilities and rights. On the other hand, Chair, you have those who are more into fathers having their full access to their children, and their inputs were a number of them, but I just highlighted the key ones, that the bill is biased towards unmarried mothers than it is to unmarried fathers, and also in the sense that it categorizes a man as either you are married or unmarried father. So they felt it's discriminatory in that sense. And also the fact that as unmarried fathers, they have to undergo expensive DNA or paternity tests when they want to apply for the registration of their children, which many of them they cannot afford because they're either not working or it is just simply too expensive for them. And then that some fathers are denied access to their children, even though they support them financially. At times they are excluded, which I think that's also an important aspect, from decision-making that involves their children. For example, when the mother wants to change the surname of the child, now the mother is marrying another man and wants to change the surname of the child to that other man, the biological father said that they are not consulted in that decision making, even though they are involved in the as far as the maintenance of the child, the financial support for the child. And also in the same breath, that they emphasize that the financial support should be not be the only recognized form of support from unmarried fathers. The fathers, they need present in the upbringing of their children, and that is very crucial in the child development. So it should not be only to the financial support, the role of fathers. There were also some criticism on the judiciary chair that the magistrates and the family advocates, the South African police service and social workers, biased against biological fathers when they consider cases of custody, divorce or separation, yes, or divorce courts were allegedly using divorce and custody processes for self-enrichment and at the expense of the child. Sorry, typing error there, at the expense of the child. So they use this process for financial gain, in a sense, that's what the document was saying. Okay, and the parental alienation was raised quite a number of times, was quite emphasized, especially the Fathers for Justice, that all this discrimination or biasness against biological fathers is a form of parental alienation, and there is strong advice that it must be treated as a form of abuse to the child. That was their submission, Chair. And also submission that in Section 22B, it stipulates that parental responsibilities and rights should be registered with the family advocate and substitute reference to the divorce court, regional court. So people saying sometimes the courts are not accessible, so that kind of cases should be dealt with at regional court. That was the submission, Chair. And then also that Section 22 of the Act now does not address potential abuse of a child's rights in instances where a child is forced to stay with his or her mother, even if the child is not in agreement. So what were the recommendations? I just want to highlight that there were quite a number of recommendations that were made. I think members, if we had time to go through the report, there's quite a long list, and I didn't want to put everything here for the sake of time. And others were clause specific, so I'm not going to go through those chapters in there. They're in the report, and they're also in the report from the national hearing. But just safe to highlight these ones, Chair. The bill should prohibit changing of surnames of children without the consent of the biological father. The law should make it possible for children to make decisions for themselves at the age of 18. Paternity tests should be done at no cost for those who cannot afford. The judiciary and the family advocate should consider meritocracy when deciding on PR, parental rights and responsibilities cases. Basically, the cases must be considered based on merit. And it was recommended that equal parental responsibility both the mother and the father for the best interests of the child. And that, Chair, the principle of 50-50 parenting was strongly raised, that it should be considered, and actually the bill should make provision on that. That was the recommendation made. And that there must be equal access to the child, even if the father is unable to pay the maintenance support for the child. The bill should protect the rights of children and both parents. The focus should be on building families and not breaking them. There should be training of social workers, family advocates, and police on how to interpret amendments to Section 21 and 22 of the bill once it has been enacted. Maybe just to mention, Chad, was when we were in the West Coast, that as private social workers, they are not that much recognized, their role, even though they play quite a significant role in assisting even state social workers in drafting these parental responsibilities and rights. So they felt like the social workers don't have enough or correct interpretation of those provisions. So the submission was that there should be training that is given to these professionals so as to know how to go about in drafting those parental responsibilities and rights. But also the question of recognition of the private social workers was also emphasized in that submission. Okay, already meant should be handled by the regional courts. Okay, Section 21C should be explicit, include that the biological father must automatically acquire parental responsibilities and rights with regard to physical, emotional, and psychological needs of the child. Section 19 should be incorporated under Section 18 of the Act, which provides that a person, including unmarried father, may be a holder of full or specific parental rights and responsibilities of the child. the bill should declare a parental alienation as another form of abuse, and they felt that the Children's Act is the best legislation to include that. Okay, then also in terms of the submission that was made that the legal fraternity uses the cases to as self-enrichment, that legal fees should be reduced for the best interest of the child, and that in sections 21 and section 33(1), there should be mandatory mediation post-divorce processes, particularly in cases where one parent does not comply with the terms of the PPR, which is parental responsibilities and rights. So there must be post-divorce processes to make sure that there's compliance. Moving now, Chair, to children's rights to privacy. On this aspect, as it was mentioned earlier, the parents, they felt that the law protects the children more than it does for the parents. And especially when it comes to the protection of the child and disciplining of the child. And they felt that if the children are given more rights, even though there's a risk, you know, of them being exposed to harmful content and bullying in media or in social media platforms. And then an example was made of, the name just escapes now, the child who committed suicide because of bullying in the cyber, in the media space, that the children still need protection from their parents. So the children's right to privacy should be balanced between the protection of the child and the rights of parenting as well, which Professor Skelton also dealt with it. Okay. I think that just sums it up. This, I just spoke to this slide, Chairperson, so I can go to the next one. And the issue of corporate punishment was also raised, that even though it was supported, it was submitted that there should be mechanism to instill discipline and guidance to the children, particularly with the increasing abuse of alcohol by children. So in other words, the public was saying that as parents, they also need some kind of support in terms of how to parent their children. I think the same point was raised by the children's, the Nelson Mandela Children's Fund, the representatives there. They actually called for training or programs for parents for positive parenting that they need to be given to parents. So they actually recommended that there should be those kind of programs made available for parents. Okay. The recommendations that the government should protect both children and parents' rights. And I just spoke into the issue, Chairperson, of training and positive disciplining of children that was raised as something that needs to be considered. And that the bill should further provide a platform for children to be allowed to be part of the decision making on matters affecting their lives. That came out very strong from the closed session with children from the Nelson Mandela Children's Fund. Chair, like I said, can I maybe skip this few slides because they speak to what the committee had already discussed in the morning about the issue of age. I will just proceed, Chair. I hope I'm in order. Okay. The issue of child marriages, the amendments were actually fully supported by the public. However, it was emphasized that the bill should clearly define the age restriction where the provision of marriage should be. And I just thought, Jefferson, there was quite an interesting link that was made between child marriages, the high teenage pregnancy rate, and the cultural practice of payment of damages or intraulo, in the sense that when a girl child is pregnant and then there's a damages that is paid, there's now always an expectation that is created that this child will be regarded as married, or in the sense that the child will start doing some wife duties, like it was said. So the input was that when with this high teenage pregnancy rate, and then we have what is now has to be done culturally, that the man or the boy or the family of the boy child now needs to go and pay damages. When that happens, then it creates this environment that the child will be regarded as a wife. Hence now, you may have a child marriage in that instance. So that mass link was made between these two, between these three instances. The other one, Chairperson, that is also linked to the high teenage pregnancy, another view was that the prohibition of child marriages may indirectly in fathers, considering the rate of high teenage pregnancy what we have right now. And so it was argued that child marriages, if that child marriages should not be prohibited if children wish to get married. Otherwise, the probabilities of the father not being fully present in the child's life are very high if they are not married. So another link, Chairperson, of child marriages with teenage pregnancy as well, a bit of a different view on it. In terms of then the recommendations that were made, the bill should also prohibit statutory rape and relationships of older men with minors. Okay, that was also raised, Chairperson, as a big issue that these children are being impregnated by older men. So hence the recommendation that there must be a prohibition, which I think there is already other laws, but it was raised here, so I must report on it. It's also the bill in this instance is silent about older men who cohabitate with younger girls. And there should be a minimum wage of consent to a marriage, and that the different laws that regulate age of consent in South Africa be reviewed. We touched on that earlier, Chairperson, with Professor Skelton. And the amendment bill should allow child marriages, child marrying another child, only for the child who has consented to that marriage. So that's the same view that I just spoke to earlier that says if we prohibit it in its entirety, child marriages, it will lead to fatherless children. So children should be allowed to marry at the age of 16, and if not, the law must prohibit children under 18 years not to fall pregnant or engage in sexual acts. That's now in line with that view that I just alluded to, Justice. That all policies and traditional or cultural practices that promote child marriages should be banned in line with the new insertion of clause 6. So this one basically it supports the amendment that is made by the bill to prohibit child marriage. Okay, going through the ECD-related issues, Chair, there are quite a number of them. Maybe I should just say here upfront, Chair, the recommendations that were made were quite long. So for the sake of this presentation, not to make it too long, already it is 48 slides, I didn't include them, but they are there, Chairperson, in the consolidated report. They are also there in the individual provincial reports. So I'm just going to highlight the issues that were raised. One was that came out very strong was the issue of funding, that there are children who are not funded. The ECD managers, they made cases where they will make an application for funding for a certain number of children, but say they applied for 60, but they'll only get funding for 30 children. And we have these other children now who are not funding, who are not funded, and that makes it difficult then for the practitioners and the managers to cater for those children. Also, the lack of funding, it makes it difficult for the centers to comply with norms and standards, and also with the COVID-19 regulations. And also the issue of the non-payment of the presidential ECD stimulus relief was also raised quite sharply, that they had not received the relief that they had applied for. Also that the means test to qualify for ECD subsidy, it creates unequal treatment for children. That was also raised as an issue in terms of the, as far as funding is concerned. And also there was concerns and complaints from the ECD practitioners that their payments of stipends are very delayed and are inconsistent, and they may be delayed up to 3 months, and the dates are not the same. 1 month they'll be paid on a certain date, and then the coming month they'll be paid on a different date. And they were really concerned about that they are not able to meet their personal expenses or needs because of this. So they really made a plea for this to be considered. And then there was also issue of the lack of support from the Department of Social Development that would include EC, the social workers. In the main, the ECD practitioners, they felt that they're not respected, they're not recognized, and the department takes decisions without consulting the sector, and also there's a lack of training of ECD practitioners. So in general, they felt they play a critical role in the development of children at the foundation level, but even so, they are not given the respect and the recognition they deserve. That was their main issue, Chairperson. And in so doing, then the bill that Fed focuses more on children's rights and services than it does on the ECD practitioners or managers for that matter. The issue of migration was also raised. Most practitioners, they welcomed it. They were quite optimistic about it because they saw it as a move that will address the challenges that they have, especially in terms of the curriculum and other issues they have. However, their main concern was that there was a lot of confusion and uncertainties because there was a lack of proper consultation and communication with the sector. For to highlight just a few, the job security of the ECD practitioners, they were worried about that, what will happen when they're now absorbed under DBE. The issue of the elderly ECD managers who had been running the centers for many years, what will happen to them? And all other issues pertaining to their security in terms of their centers and their employment were raised, Chairperson, and all of that because they felt that they were never consulted properly on this migration. And the issue of the registration of partial care, that including the ECDs, this was also raised at the national platform that we had of public hearings, that the process is quite tedious, it is oppressive, and is quite lengthy, and also that the documents that they need to submit, for example, the business plans are quite expensive to draft, as well as the renewal of the compliance certificates or health compliance certificates is quite lengthy and it's costly as well. And all of these, speakers that felt it creates a divide between the urban and the rural ECD centers because rural areas must have the infrastructure and resources they need than those that maybe are in the more urban areas. The role of municipalities, Chairperson, was also, it came out very strong, the lack of support from the municipalities. In so doing, they are failing to implement their legislative mandate as far as support that needs to be given to the sector. And also that that came out very strong in Gauteng in terms of regard to the municipalities charging very exorbitant amounts for the bylaws and the zoning of land that they cannot they can't afford. And one lady mentioned that even the municipal bills were quite expensive, that in one instance, I think her one was about 40,000 rand, that a municipal bill that was charged for a center, and she obviously could not be cannot be able to pay for that one. So that was raised as a big concern, Chair. And just to mention here, the recommendation was that the ECD sector or the centers, they must also be regarded as indigent. So the indigent policy should also be applicable to the ECD sector. That's what was raised, which I thought was interesting to raise here. Another issue that was raised, which was quite concerning from the public, that is, that parents, they will take their children to school who are as young as 3 to 4 years old or 4 to 5. And they felt like the parents do that because at the center, city centers, they need to pay a fees. Whereas if they go to those schools that are exempted, that they don't have to pay a school fees, then the parent would rather than take the child to the school than to the center where the parent would be expected to pay fees. So you have this 3 to 4 year olds and 4 to 5 year olds who are now enrolled in mainstream schools. And the concern was that these children, they find it very difficult to adapt to the curriculum because they are young. and the school environment, and because they are not yet ready to be in that environment, others are still in the NAPIS. It was also alluded to that. And in terms of potty training as well, they're not well potty trained. They then tend to be bullied or laughed at school, and that affects their self-esteem. And also the fact that the schooling system does not have aftercare. So these children, after school, they have nowhere to go because they may have go home, but there won't be any supervision that way because the parents are at work. So these children are left now on their own, not being attended to. Also, children with disabilities, one of the areas that were raised, the inclusion of children with disabilities in definition of ECD was supported, as I said earlier. However, there was a general concern of discrimination, bullying, and ridiculing of children with disabilities in school. And also, ECD centers and other public buildings do not have appropriate infrastructure for children with disabilities. And the ECD sector, they also submitted that they do not have a curriculum or support in terms of training on how to now work with children with disabilities. So that was raised. Like I said, Chair, in terms of recommendations, that one, Chairperson, they are in the report. Just to mention that a specific mention was made of children with autism and albinism who are ill-treated, abused, and discriminated against. Particularly, this one speaker mentioned that children with autism, they have a wide spectrum of symptoms that they have autism, and because of that, they require a specialized skill, and they find it hard to integrate into the society and also into the school. So they felt that that needs to be taken into consideration when now the children with disabilities are being now included in the ECD program. Also, the issue of schools for children with special needs not being enough, and those existing ones, they have long waiting lists for parents about their children. So you find most children, they end up not being in school because the waiting list is too long in schools. And on top of that, we don't have enough schools in South Africa for children with learning with special needs. Most children with disabilities are forced to exit special schools when they reach the age of 18. I think Chair is something similar to the issue of children exiting the foster care. In this instance, is those children who are in the special schools that also have to leave the schools at the age of 18. Okay, coming to foster care, and that is including grants. The main concerns that were raised was that the application process and the renewal of court orders takes too long. I think the committee is quite well aware of that. And the fact that children who turn 18, I have to support even the financial support and protection. And one case was made of a child who had to live on the street in the bushes somewhere because that child had nowhere to go after exiting the foster care system. That the foster care grant and the child support grant are often abused by parents and caregivers. The committee was told a lot for a number of cases where parents use the money for their own personal use, gambling, buying cell phones, buying alcohol, going to the taverns, and neglecting the needs of children. Because many of these parents are young parents. If we can consider in the context of the high teenage pregnancy, so you have these young parents who receive the child support grant, and instead of using that grant for the interest of the child or benefit of the child, they use it for their own personal use. That was raised by a lot of parents. Yeah? And there's also a lack of protection of children or adopted or foster children or adopted children when the parents die. We learned a lot of children who, when the parents adopted them, die, those children do not have protection from the remaining members of the family. And also the fact that grandparents or family members who do not know the whereabouts of the parents are not able to apply for foster care grant. Okay. The recommendations was that the termination of foster care grant and foster care, those children, for example, in the foster care homes, for children above the age of 18 should be reviewed to 21 years or 25 years, depending on the circumstances of the child. Social workers should constantly monitor children receiving foster care grants to determine whether their grant is used for intended purposes and prevent abuse and neglect of children. There should be education programs about foster care and adoption to the general public, as there is a general lack of understanding about them. Hence, the person earlier alluded to the fact that these children, when the parents are no more, they tend to be rejected by the remaining members of the family. Interesting recommendation was made that when the screening process is done for foster care and adoption, it should not only be limited to the parents, the adoptive parents, it should also be extended to the immediate family members to avoid children being exposed to harmful things that can be done to them. Or, like I said, some of them end up being rejected by families. One speaker mentioned that we may find out that another member of the immediate family who was not screened, maybe that person has a criminal record, but that was never taken into consideration when the child was placed. So hence, it must be extended to all the immediate family members there. Okay, when it comes to adoptions, okay, the issue of deletion of Section 249, which the committee is quite well aware of, was sharply raised during the national hearings. It was raised that it could have unintended consequences, which may have negative effect on the system as a whole, and it will apply. It may allow for potential exploitation of mothers and children, and that many of the adoption accredited designated child protection organizations and private adoption social workers will no longer be able to cover the inherent cost of the program if this section is 249 is deleted. And also it could lead to further decline in the adoption targets. And that focus should instead be on addressing delays in the administrative processes from provincial departments in issuing of Section 2391C, which is the issuing of the letters of recommendation that the are needed for the adoption processes to be finalized. Adoption is a highly specialized skill, adoption is highly specialized and complex, and so it must be handled by trained and experienced professional social workers. And as it is now, the concern was that DSD already has associates of social workers. So this was raised as a concern that if now those who are specialized in the field are being taken off from this process, then may cause a problem in the adoption service. And then this is a technical input here that there is a consistency of the use of adoption social worker as it is defined currently in the Act. The proposed amendments, they only to 239 and 252, they refer to social worker responsible for adoption, whereas the Act talks about adoption social workers. So there's that inconsistency. So what are the recommendations? So in order for the bill to be consistent and avoid confusion, it should refer to adoption social worker employed by the department as it is currently defined in the Act. Parliament should keep Section 249 and Regulation 107 as part of the legislation and to rather take measures to simplify the adoption process. Section 239D of the Act should be amended to give timeframes of the issuance of the recommendation letter by provincial DSD. Okay, and also that associating legal adoption with child trafficking should be stopped. Rather, more support should be given to accredited social adoption service providers in open, transparent, and legally guided adoption processes. taking too long. And also there should be penalties for anyone rendering adoption services without accreditation and registration with the department, and then adoption should be regarded as a specialized service. I'm almost done, Chair. 3.10 talks to the referral of a child to a place of safety or in safe care. There was a concern raised that there is a confusion regarding provisions of Clause 83 and Clause 87. Clause 83 states that a social worker must investigate the matter of a child and within 90 days compile a report on whether the child is in need of care and protection. However, Clause 87 states that the child should not be in a temporary safe care for longer than 72 hours without a court order. So the social workers who raised this, they felt like this creates confusion, because in one clause it talks about 90 days, and in the other one it talks about 72 hours of a child who is now needs to be assessed and have a court order to be placed in a temporary safe care, which I think the department will respond to that. And also that there's a lack of clarity in the bill on instances when the prescribed time lapses before a child is placed in the temporary safe care. Some cases are reported during the weekend or long weekends when some services are not available that are needed in terms of the investigations of the matter. So there is no clarity what happens when the prescribed time lapses and the child has not yet been placed on temporary safe care. And the recommendations, the proposed period of 72 hours should be extended to 5 working days. The 6 month period proposed in amending section 87 is too short. The period should be extended to a year. The process of placing a child in temporary safe care should be handled by the Department of Justice and Constitutional Court, Constitutional Development timeously. The National Child Protection Register, the Part B, this was also raised in the national for applications, and it can take up to 3 months. And some the ECD sector, they even raised that they will need to employ a person, but they now delayed because of the delays in the in terms of getting feedback on the application, and in some instances they end up employing that particular person. And just as I stated that it takes up to 3 months, even though the act it says the feedback must be provided within 21 days. So you can see that there's quite a lot of delay, diversion is also from the act. So the recommendation was that the register should be devolved to provincial departments of social development. That way then it will be able to be fast track the issue of application and outcome. And also that the register should be linked to the South African Police Service Criminal Register, as this register contains detailed information about the person, like I said, the criminal register, so it has more detail about the person than the National Child Protection Register. Almost done, I'm left with only 2 slides. There is, in terms of the implementation and nature of the bill, there was an input that was made that there's a lack of proper monitoring of the act and its regulations. And so there are people who are not well informed about its provision. I think it also speaks to what I said earlier about the interpretation of the section that deals with drafting of the parental responsibilities and rights agreements. Chairperson, there's one input that was made concerning the bill itself, that they felt like the bill is in its current form is unconstitutional and should be withdrawn. Just to give a bit of a summary on this one, the speaker alluded that a petition was submitted to Parliament, and this petition had thousands of signatories, and they were calling for the bill to be withdrawn by Parliament because it is unconstitutional. Chairperson, we made a follow-up later on this submission, and we found out that this petition was never referred to the committee. So as far as the committee is concerned, it never received this petition, so we can't really make a comment on it because it was never referred to it. That's how far it goes as far as the committee is concerned, Chair. There's a new proposal, Chairperson. It's not new in the sense of to the committee, because it was also written as a national platform as well, but it's new in terms of it's a new proposal to be inserted in the bill, because the bill does not address this. So this proposal, Chairperson, is basically a way that it tries to protect children who are abandoned. So with the argument is that South Africa has a high number of children who are abandoned in unsafe places. This is because the law in South Africa right now makes it a criminal offense to abandon a child. So you have these mothers who then abandon their children in rubbish bins, all these unsafe places. So the aim of the safe havens or baby savers then protect and save lives of these children in their for the best, in keeping with the principle of the best interest of the child. So this submission then or the proposal calls for South Africa to legalize safe abandonment through the safe havens or baby savers. The recommendations here is that there should be adoptions to prioritize children who are abandoned. The bill should regulate that all organizations working with babies should partner with DSD, and failure to cooperate with the department will result to closure of the organization. Make the anonymous safe relinquishment of children legal, basically the abandonment of children be legal, so that abandoned children can be cared for appropriately and their lives saved. And then start being accountable by keeping accurate statistics of child abandonment, abuse, neglect, and exploitation. Okay, I'm done, Chair. Just to say, the committee has a wealth of information, primary information before it, that came from the provincial public hearings and the national public hearings, in essence, the both platforms, the issues that are raised are quite similar. They may vary in detail, but the crux of the matter that we raise are quite similar. So it is then crucial that the committee going forward, it considers all these reports that are before it, the report on the summaries that was provided, I made a presentation on it. There was a report on the national public hearings that I also presented only to the committee. There's this report now on the provincial hearing. All of these reports, they contain quite crucial information for the committee to deliberate on. I thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Loli. It was not easy to make this summary because it took some months and months, and you have tried to collect everything. I could see that it's a long report to try to summarize it. Thank you very much. We really appreciate that. And when I listen to you, I think you have tried to cover most of other things, but let me give over to honorable members to check whether is there anything that needs to be added on the presentation.
Yes, Chair.
I see.
Honorable Magari, I can also speak my head.
Honorable Abrams and Honorable Mangani. Can you go to Honorable Aris?
Yeah, thank you very much, Chair. Chair, I just want to check, there was an issue raised in terms of social support. That fathers that are part of the children's life, you know, as from day one, and then there was this guy, I don't know in which place we were, I'm not sure if it was one of the last provinces that we visited, because he did raise that issue of social fathers. that is the fathers that are there in the children's lives right from day one, physically, emotionally, financially is there, and where the biological father is absent. And that person that are the father figure, that children's life, you know, you don't have any rights. Maybe I have missed it, and maybe Yoli did cover that one. I'm not so sure, but that one was definitely raised in the public hearings. And how will we cover, you know, those?
Abraham.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you to Yoli and everybody who assisted in drafting the report. Chair, just excuse my ignorance, adopting the report today does not mean we all necessarily agree to the recommendations today. Am I correct? I said, excuse my ignorance, but I just would like to confirm by adopting the report, if we adopt the report today, it's not necessary meaning we're adopting all the recommendations. Or by adopting it, are we agreeing to all the recommendations today?
Yes, I do so. Because Galop, the recommendation has been put there. If you want to add one of other that has been left, we can add. If we want to delete one of the recommendations that have been put there, we can do that. So it's our opportunity, so as to adopt the report.
Okay, thank you, Chief. Then I have questions if that's in the case. And then I just would like to find out, in terms of the statistical analysis, are our numbers acceptable to Parliament to proceed, noting that it was COVID and we did have COVID regulations in place that limited, spacing and could have also limited the number of attendees. So are we on par and is our numbers acceptable to proceed? Then I'd also like to just confirm with regard to the ECD section, will this committee be making any changes or will we be sticking to our previous recommendation that all ECD changes will then be handed over to DBE and they will do all the ECD changes in the second amendment bill? So those are two questions. Then coming now to the recommendations, I know on slide 18, the one recommendation was to then regulate legal fees when it comes to parents, and divorce cases and getting access to their children. But couldn't the legal fraternity just argue then that if parents don't want to accept their fees, then they should use other methods such as legal aid and then to find a lawyer that is more in line with their financial standing than to regulate the entire legal fraternity in that? Then also on the issue of child marriages, and by not allowing child marriages, it leads to fatherlessness. I think we should just be careful. While it did come up in the discussion, and therefore the comments need to be noted in discussion, I'm of the opinion that should not then recommend that link between not allowing child marriages equaling fatherlessness. Should not, Yuli, yeah? Should I stop?
No, continue.
Yuli's got her hand up. I think she wants to just stop me or something.
Yes,
no. Why don't you?
No, okay, maybe I should wait. I don't know, but maybe Mrs. Linda can assist me, Chair. But the process of committee deliberating on the inputs is still coming, Chair. And I expect that the departments are still going to come and respond to the recommendations, for example, that were raised and all the inputs that were raised. So I'm thinking maybe premature now to engage on that until we have the departments that will respond to it, and then the committee may deliberate then on what was raised, Chair. I thought maybe I should make you aware of
Okay. Let's just have all the questions people that are having, and then you can summarize by answering all of them. But it's fine for this one.
Okay. Well, then, Chair, I'll continue, but then maybe just to note it that, I mean, there are people in marriages and it can still lead to fatherlessness. So I don't think that association should be made in the recommendation. And then also, Chair, I'm very happy to see that you are going to include, well, hopefully include the baby safe havens. And then just to mention, I'm busy reading a dissertation called The Legal Regulation of Infant Abandonment in South Africa, which would be very constructive to that discussion. And then secondly, Chair, on the issue of the exit age from foster care and exit age, especially from child and youth care centres. Now, children over the age of 18 does not fall within the mandate of social development, but we do have a department that focuses on youth, and it would be just very interesting to hear what that department is doing to protect these 18-year-olds once they exit out of these systems. And then just lastly, Chair, it goes without saying, but I think I feel that I just need to say it, because every morning we wake up and there's another woman and child murdered in this country, that, you know, automatic access by fathers is for the rights and responsibilities part, but, you know, then it becomes access to the child. And, you know, I think the discussion with most of those fathers is that while they may have the rights and responsibilities, they don't have access to the child, and that we should maybe look at it at access and the rights and responsibilities. But also, if the mother has protection orders in place, if any of the parent appears on child protection registers, etc., you know, that access and that automatic access will of course need to be determined by the court. So it goes without saying, but you know, we live in a country where every morning you wake up, and I just feel it needs to be said again. But thank you, Chairperson.
Okay, thank you, Honorable Abrams. Honorable Mangani.
Thank you.
And followed by
you very much, Chair, and thank you very much, Yoli. Mine is just to check. When we were in Free State, the social workers says, I didn't get it clear on this report. I'm not debating, but I want to check if we have captured it very good. The one of the social workers saying they are having the memorandum of understanding as the province of Free State. They're having the memorandum of understanding with the ambassador of Lesotho. So that the children should get documentation. I'm just checking if maybe we'll discuss it when we discuss the report. I'm just checking if that was my understanding. If that is was my understanding, it means we are going to have a province that is doing its own thing, even if it's not recommended by the government, that you can do whatever documentation with the ambassadors, while other countries that they are saying they don't have documentation, their ambassadors are not given that latitude maybe to can contact their ambassador to assist them. I was just thinking if that is legal.
Okay. Thank you, Honorable Mangani. Then can we follow by Honorable Kate and Honorable Masango, followed by Honorable Stock.
Thank you,
Honorable Kate.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you very much for the presentation or the report crafted by
our content advisor and the collective. Chair, I also heard the content advisor saying can't we wait for the department in order to raise this question with them? But one thing that I think it needs here to clarify is that one of the petition. I can't remember whether it's on slide number 46 or 45, where she said that there was a petition that has been sent to Parliament, but it didn't reach the portfolio committee. I want to check if there is no consequences concerning that, since there is an allegation that there is this petition that has been signed off by so many people, sent to Parliament in order to stop this bill. And on our side, we didn't receive the petition. What is it that we can do, or are we not going to find ourselves having a problem without acting or responding to that petition? And I'm not so sure now, Chair, if I can proceed in asking questions, or I must wait for the department to present, then we raise some of the issues, because I think it's more related to the department.
Okay, comrades, Honorable Masango.
I'm saying I am not Comrade Masango. And thank you so much, Chairperson, for this opportunity. And thank you very much to Yolisa and the colleagues that have, her colleagues that have assisted in putting this report together. Chair, I had questions, but after the question of Honorable Abrahams and the response by Yoli, I sort of changed my mind because I need clarity. My understanding was that today's meeting, or at least this part of the meeting, is for Yoli to present to us the deliberations of the public hearings, because we were there at different times. And then for us to say today, we agree, it's like minutes of meetings, pretty much, for us to agree that we believe that, having listened to the presentation in conjunction with reading the reports that she has sent us, that the committee support have sent us, we agree that it is a reflection of what happened during the public hearings. And that would be the basis of us adopting or not adopting the report. And then any other information that in the intervening time we have gathered, or we have ourselves just, you know, thought about and things like that, we still, during this process of the processing of, during the processing of proffering that information and as we interact with the people that drafted the bill. So now I'm not going to go into questions, because I need that, if possible, Chair, if you agree, I need at least my view to be confirmed or not. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. I have a question necessarily which I want to pose with regard to the report that was presented by the content advisors, my submission in this manner. Also, just to start by appreciating, joining my colleagues, the comprehensive report which was presented by Yoli, which of course led the team that was working with her to compile the report. Now, I'm partly covered by Honorable Masango, objective of today's meeting.
And I would say that I might lose my understanding, but I stand to be corrected. Today's meeting, based on the report, was just a post for us, like Honorable Masango is putting it. The report presented by the content advisor to us is more like, this is what happened in the public hearings. Do you agree or you don't agree? If we say yes, we agree as honorable members, this is a true reflection. The report reflects our activity as a portfolio committee in those provinces as part of the public hearings. Then, of course, we need to adopt the report. And then once the report is duly adopted, we'll have our time or an opportunity as honorable members in the next meeting where the report will be tabled, or maybe any other opportunity will be given to us, where we'll now be able to go through the blow-by-blow issues in relation to the clause-by-clause in the bill, as well as the recommendations. So if my understanding is confirmed and it's correct, Honorable Chairperson, I was going to also propose that we move and adopt the report as a true reflection of the meeting.
Okay, thank you, Honorable
Stock. I've raised my hand, Chair.
Oh, okay. Okay, Honorable Jay.
Chair, I do agree with the two speakers, Honorable Dikgang and Honorable Masang. That's why I was putting this thing to say, I don't see what the Free State have said, because before I adopt, I must just put something that I don't see that was raised in that meeting. I do agree 100% with them. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, honorable members. You know, I'm also a little bit confused on the processes going to discuss the bill itself, on what is it that exactly we should do now. Because I am also thinking that we would at least follow what Honorable Stock, Honorable Masango, including Honorable Jane, the process of this bill. I really now a little bit not sure exactly what is it that we are supposed to do. Maybe only you can come again explaining on what is it that needs to happen from now. Otherwise, in terms of the reports, the only thing maybe we have to add is things that we think they are missing in the report. And going towards the adoption process, I thought we have to add and we have to discuss and we have to maybe delete if we want to, and then adopt the report. So I'm not sure now whether where do I miss now this thing of discussing the bill. Yoli?
Okay. Thank you. I'll give you a platform.
Yes. Yes.
Chair. Just to respond to the query, Sis Lindy, she is a better person to advise in terms of procedure. What would be the way forward? But safe to say that the inputs from Honorable Masango, Honorable Stock, and Mamu Jane, they are correct, but also Linda will elaborate on that. Just maybe to, before I give to Cecilia in this chat, just to respond to issues that were directed to me. Mamu Iris, okay, you are putting something that's not there. I think I seem to remember that submission of that father. I will add into the report that's in order. Mama Jane, I didn't see this because I went through all the submissions of the provincial reports. Unfortunately, Free State, that's one province. I was in there. My child was not well. I had to come back, but I will make a follow-up on this one because it's quite important. And then I will then make the amendments on the report once I've have consulted with my colleagues. Maybe I missed it somewhere. Thank you, Ma. I'll do that. And with the regard to the status of the ECG clauses, if you remember, the advice was that we will continue with the process. But at the end of the process, the committee will then reject those clauses. So the legislative process is unfolding. We continue with it, with all the inputs that we are getting. However, nothing changes in terms of the decision that was made. In terms of the acceptable statistical statistics, in terms of numbers, maybe my colleague Unati can assist me on this one. I am not quite sure if there's any acceptable statistics in Parliament in terms of the public hearings and of numbers, how many should they be. I'm not aware of that, but maybe Unati can assist me on this one. And then the issue of the petition. Chair, this came up in Western Cape in Khayelitsha. There is a member from Bayakanya Foundation, it's an adoption sector, who wanted to know what happened to the petition that was submitted to Parliament. And in essence, this petition called for the bill to be withdrawn from Parliament, meaning the committee, before even the committee considers the bill, because they felt that it was unconstitutional. Now, we were not aware of that. We then came back and follow-up made, and it then was established that the petition was submitted to the, there was a correspondence, let me put it that way. There was a correspondence between the stakeholder and the office of speaker. So as far as that petition is concerned, it ended at that level. It was never referred to us through the normal processes of Parliament, which is ATC. So it was then left to the office of the speaker to deal with that, because it was never referred to the committee. Our legal advisor is aware of this. I briefed him. Maybe he can then add in terms of the implications of that, because I briefed him on this matter, Chair. But as far as the committee is concerned, and Sis Lindwe maybe can give even more clarity, the formal process of Parliament of referring it to the committee was never done. The correspondence that we saw in terms of follow-up were between the Speaker's office and the office replying to the stakeholders. That's where it all ended as far as this bill is concerned. It didn't come to us, Chair. But let me leave it to my colleagues who are better placed to explain the issue of the purpose of this meeting and the process for Sis Lindiwe, who need to assist me with if there's any acceptable steps in terms of Parliament to proceed with the bill, and also the implications of this petition. Thank you. To you, colleagues.
Thank you, Lori.
And then who's speaking now?
It's Lindy, what you're saying.
Okay, please,
okay. Thank you very much, Chair. I just want to provide guidance regarding the process we're at now. This is part of the consultation process whereby the committee gets information on its process of public participation. So this process now is to check whether what is in the report is a true reflection of what transpired during the public hearings. So this is like adopting the minutes. So if you agree or whether the report is a true reflection, and then we adopt the report. If there is some information that has been omitted, we add that information and then we adopt the report. And the content of the report would be useful during the formal stage of the process, because now we are still in the informal stage, because the DSD will come next week to respond to the issues raised. SALGA, Justice Department, and Department of Home Affairs will come to respond. So this is part of the information sharing system, a process. So to capacitate members to be aware of issues that were raised during the public hearings, and the response came from the respective stakeholders having the responsibility of executing such problem. So when you are at the formal stage dealing with clause by clause, you will be mindful of a process of a issue that has been raised and been responded to. And then you can deliberate and propose or take a recommendation on a particular organization if you deem it fit to be to make such amendments in the former stage, which is clause by clause. For now, is the consultation and then information sharing process for the committee in preparation of the former stage, where we consider the bill clause by clause. So I think that's where I just need to provide guidance on. Thank you very much. I think Jay will, and just to inform Jay, our legal advisor can speak to the issue of the petition and issue of the steps. Jenwana, can you respond, or maybe I can respond later on, because I don't foresee any a number of participants that must have in order for a bill or an act to be recognized as we conducted a public participation process. I think at that time we complied to COVID-19 regulations of not more than 100, and we went to 9 provinces, and then we went to 4 districts. So I think that's a fair public participation process, but I think the legal advisor can elaborate more in terms of whether we have complied, whether there will be any litigation or any challenges as far as our public participation process is concerned. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Can we give over to our legal advisor?
Thank you very much, this is Matt Njerman, the legal advisor. Can you hear me clearly, Chair?
Yes.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chair, I will start with the question relating to the petition. it in its amendment process. So in this regard, I would point the committee to the guidance of the Constitutional Court in very key judgments that talk about public participation, which is the Doctors for Life judgment, and quite recently the La Musa versus the Speaker decision. Both these decisions are decisions of the Constitutional Court, Chairperson. They provide Parliament with the necessary guidance as to what is the yardstick to test whether public participation has been sufficiently undertaken or discharged as a constitutional responsibility by the committee. Chair, one of the first important things I'd like to mention about these decisions, which serve as a guidance, is that there is no barometer to test the sufficient public participation, because the judgments themselves and by the court's own decision, there is no prescribed number of people to be consulted in order for the committee to say it has done public participation. The constitution and the rules grant the committee the inherent power to determine its own internal mechanisms and therefore to determine its own program for consultation, taking into consideration all of the prevailing circumstances. And that would include the issue of COVID-19 that has been prevailing, Chairperson. It would also include the laws that are applicable around the issue of COVID-19 management, which is the Disaster Management Act, and the limitation of numbers in public venues that can be consulted, Chairperson. Therefore, Chair, the standard coming from the decision of the Constitutional Court is that there must be reasonable and effective public participation in the view of the committee. So it is the committee itself that must design a consultation program, and the committee must itself believe that it is reasonable, effective, and it is fair, and that all of the interested and affected parties, meaning the key stakeholders in relation to the contents of the bill, have been consulted on the bill. And then on that basis, the committee can then confirm to itself that it has indeed consulted reasonably and it has met the constitutional threshold that is put upon it in terms of the committee discharging its constitutional responsibility to consult the public in this bill, Chairperson.
Okay.
So I hope that answers the question on the constitutional guidance regarding the prescribed barometer for public consultation, Chair. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Chanong. I see that there are hands. Can I give over to those hands? Stembile, Honorable Song.
Thank you very much, Chair. Chair, I think with the advice from the legal and content advisor, I would like to second Mr. Stock in adopting the report, with also noting what Mom Jane raised about the Free State, that it should be in that on this report. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Msongo. Who else is hand up? No one. Eh? Okay. Then can we then adopt the report?
Chair?
Yes.
Yes, I move for the adoption of the report with the amendment that has been raised. I thank you, Chair.
Yes. Okay. Honorable Kate, move with amendments. Any seconder?
Honorable Msongo did second.
Honorable Jane, I requested again for people to adopt the report. So it seems as if you are also seconding.
Yes, Chair, I'm seconding.
Thank you very much, Honorable. I think we are done with amendments, Honorable Members, because you could see that we have managed to add some of the things that have been highlighted. Lindiwe, where do we go from here? The report, I mean the program of the committee.
Yes, Chair, we are done. We are done with a comprehensive report that you only just presented, which is a document that came from the 9 provincial reports from various provinces, meaning that you are also adopting those 9 provincial reports. Chair?
Yeah.
What I'm saying, the comprehensive report that Yoli presented, it's a document extrapolated from the reports of various
9 provinces. Yes.
Nine provinces, which means that the comprehensive report and also you are also adopting the individual reports in one report.
Yes.
Okay. No, thanks, Chair. The next item for discussion
the program.
Is the program. Yes, Chair.
Yes.
Must I flight it?
Please.
Okay. Is it order? Can you see it?
Yes.
Okay, Chair. Must I take the committee through?
Please.
Okay. Chair and members, and I think we're almost at the end of the program. I'm presenting today's program. And then next week, which is Professor Skelton and Yoli and adoption of the program done. Next week, Chair, we were supposed to do the briefing from social development, also the same responding to issues raised during public hearings on the Children's Amendment Bill. We also, Chair, scheduled to also get a response from SAGA. They responded to say that they are not available next week to brief the committee. They have other engagement. So they requested that we scheduled an alternative date for them to appear before the committee. So next week is only DSD and minutes. And the second, Chair, we will receive a briefing from the Department of Home Affairs as well as the Department of Justice, also responding to the issues raised during public hearings. And on the 4th of March, the Department of Basic Education is responding to issues raised during provincial public hearings. As well, on the 9th, we are starting with the formal stage where we'll start adopting the motion of desirability, and then we'll start with the clause-by-clause session, and then up to the 25th of March. Chair, I also want to bring to the attention of the committee on a request that the committee should also schedule a joint meeting with the Portfolio Committee on Basic Education to get progress on the migration of the ECD from DSD to basic education. After consultation with the chairperson and also to look at the program of the DBE, Chair, I wish to also inform the committee that we can set aside the date of the 9th of March for the joint committee with provincial MECs and HODs to come and present their readiness for the migration of the ECD from DSD to DBE. So the tentative date is the 9th of March, Chair. And then we'll also try to fit in the SALGA to come and present to the committee the responses pertaining to the issues raised during the public hearing. So the program ends on the 25th. I think Parliament closes on the 25th of March. Chair, I don't think, and members, I don't think by this time the committee will already concluded the process. We might need also look at using other Fridays or maybe 2 or 3 days during constituency, because the House Chairperson instructed that legislation committees need to finalize legislation during this term, which is March. So, and secondly, Chair and committee members, the issue of the fundraising amendment bill, we'll consider that one in the next term. So that's the committee program before the committee for consideration and adoption. I thank you, Chair.
And members.
Honorable members, this is the report that is presented to us. What do you think?
Chair, it's Honorable Abrams here. I move for the adoption of the program, and thank you very much for including that draft date on ECD migration.
Second.
Member Masango's hand is up, Chair.
Member Masango.
Thank you, Chair. Before I second, which I probably will, I just would like to know, we had this system, now that we're talking about the program of the committee, the legal advisor earlier on outlined what is possible to happen with regards to the petition. I just want to know if I'm not preempting anything. I would like to know if that would interfere with the processing of the bill to meet the deadline for which this bill is being done. Thank you so much. Otherwise, I second the bill. I mean, I second the adoption of the program. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you, Honorable Masango. The next item, Lindy, it's closure.
We conclude the business, Chair, yes.
Yeah, okay. Thank you ever so much to everyone, my colleagues, honorable members, and the officials. The meeting stands adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you. Thank you, honorable members.
Thank you.
I'm going to end the meeting.
Can I end? Look fresh, eh? Hey, Lindy.
I see that.
Hey, I look so fresh. Hey, let's change, right?
It's a new year, you know. In fifth floor, you always need to
cover your yourself.
Lindy.
Hello, ma'am. Hello, ma'am.
Why did you not answer my question about the petition and the program of the committee?
President, the meeting is over.
I know. I'm not going to let this one go.
I thought maybe the legal advisor myself would be given an opportunity to respond.
Take the opportunity. Take the opportunity next time, please.
Can't just, you know, I need to, I'm led. I can't be a leader being led.
I'm gonna re-ask my question next week, believe it or not.
You know what? I think what will happen as a matter, as soon as we do the actual investigation on the matter, né? And yes. I think myself and Yoli and Jenane will need to meet and ascertain what effect will this have to the committee. And that must happen before the 13th, where we start with the formal stage.
So yes, because,
that's why I was asking.
Yes, I think by then we need to make things, you know, exactly what is expected of us so that we know yes. the process is not being
interfered. You're welcome.
Yes, okay.
So we'll make a follow up on it.
No, that's fine.
Okay, Gemma.
Thanks, Lindy.
Okay, bye.
Yes. Bye.
Hello, ma'am. Hi.
Yes. No, no, you can end the meeting.
Okay, my dear. See you next week. See you next week, members. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.